Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Jeffrey P. Nesker, a director whose first feature, Elsewhere in New York, traces a romantic triangle between a woman, her boyfriend, and his new roommate, who turns out to be an old flame. It's now available for rent and purchase on iTunes in Canada and on iTunes and Amazon Video in the US. It's worth looking for. Jeffrey picked Alien 3, David Fincher's 1992 entry in the 20th Century Fox sci-fi franchise, which kind of got clobbered when it was first released. It's the one that wiped away the triumphs of James Cameron's Aliens to leave Sigourney Weaver's Ripley doomed, depressed, and stuck on a prison planet filled with religious zealots and one very hungry monster. It's kind of a mess, but 25 years later, it's very clearly a mess of interesting ideas connected by a powerful visual sensibility. This may have been Fincher's first feature, but he knew what he was doing. And the version that made it to theaters is no longer the only point of reference anyway. Don't worry, I'll explain everything. Or Jeffrey will. We'll get to it. This is someone else's movie.
Well, I'm a sci-fi nerd. And I'm going to tell you a tall tale right now. And you won't believe me, but it doesn't matter because it's true.
Okay.
So my Zeta Harry, he lived on Antibes Drive, which is right across the street from Newton Brook Bowlerama, which is, you went to Newton Brook High School.
Yeah, I remember Antibes.
But do you remember the Bowlerama at that plaza right on Bathurst and Finch? It's like a Shoppers and a Loblaws.
Yeah, I think
and
so. It was okay. Southwest Corner.
Proper North York. Yeah. So he had, and I don't remember the naming conventions, was it First Choice and then First Choice the Movie Channel and then the Movie
First
Channel?
Super Channel. Okay. And so, the Movie Network, yeah.
Well, I think the Movie Network was after the Movie Channel. And possibly. For some time, I think they doubled down and they were like First Choice the Movie Channel, which was like a super tongue twister. Anyway, what? Aliens came out 86 theatrically, right?
Right, yeah.
So let's say 87, like early double digits, maybe like 11 years old. And I go to see, I watch Alien at my Zeta's house. Sorry, Aliens. And I swear to you, it's the director's cut. I swear to you. So we're talking Ripley's daughter stuff.
Right.
And we're talking the sentry guns, right, which were the best thing ever, and I don't know why they cut them.
I don't think that's possible. Are you sure you didn't messing it up with the TV broadcasts?
Because
that was where they introduced the director's material.
Maybe I am. But regardless, right, I watched it on TV.
So that was your first experience of Aliens.
With my first experience of Aliens. So flash forward now to Alien 3. And I'm sure my dad took me to see it in the States because it was a hard R, right? So there's no way I would have seen it.
Might have been AA up here.
You think?
Maybe. I couldn't tell you.
Well, regardless,
we definitely didn't have 14A or...
No, we did, it was way before 14A.
Right.
So I'm sure my dad took me just to get me in the door, and I saw the assembly cut, bits and pieces of it, theatrically. I know the look on your face tells me you're not going to believe it. I'm not sure if it was the oxen alien or the dog alien, but I absolutely remember this scene where they trapped the alien in the... toxic waste room and then Golic lets him out because he's gone totally mental.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my tall tale about watching both of them.
How old would you have been then?
Because Alien 3 is what? 92. So I would have been maybe 14, 15.
Because this stuff fascinates me. Is it possible you read the novelization and you just sort of put it in there?
You know, I was looking for... Alan Dean Foster novelized every last one of them, right? Like, he's the go-to guy for all sci-fi novelizations.
Right.
And I didn't read it on the Wikipedia page, but I think he had a... Like, this was, if you pardon the pun, this was an awfully long gestation, this project. And I don't know if he did the novelization for Alien 3.
I want to say yes, but I can't remember.
99% of me wants to say yes. But no, I absolutely remember seeing that scene. And then when I bought it on home video later, I was wondering why the hell that scene was missing.
Yeah. And this is pre-internet and pre any other place you could have seen it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know. It sounds totally unbelievable.
Where in the States did you see it?
It would have been either Buffalo or Detroit. It couldn't have been Miami.
Just some kind of bad reel got shipped somewhere?
Yeah, I mean...
I want to believe these stories.
I want you to believe this story because it makes me sound like I was in the right place at the right time twice. But like that's the way I remember it. And so, you know, Alien 3, because I was such a fan and because I was so invested in the characters and the story, And because I had read the Dark Horse Comics continuation that had sort of taken it in a different direction, I had a lot of anticipation for it. I knew nothing about how troubled the production it was. I knew nothing about the endless rewrites and all of the dissension. And it rocked my world. I mean, it absolutely destroyed me. It destroyed me before the opening credits were over, because it's, in my opinion, probably the most subversive franchise film ever made. Probably the darkest franchise film ever made. Like, just unrepentantly bleak and nihilistic.
Yeah.
You know, for my young eyes, I was so, like, the experience of watching it the first time, I was just so pissed the entire way through, you know? Like, they killed my guys! And they killed them unceremoniously while they were still going through the credits roll, right? So I remember the experience was utter disappointment, but the mood of it, like just this pervasive mood of dread, was so, it stayed with me for a long, like it's still with me. It's one of the, it's a film that I think is absolutely shaped who I am as an artist, and what kind of things attract me as an artist. It really blew my mind. Absolutely.
That's fascinating. I mean, I remember my first experience of it was, I think the first hour is incredibly solid, and then the theatrical cut anyway, starts to drift in ways that are unsatisfying to me. I think I have no problem with the alien films sort of switching tones and genre. I think that's the most fascinating thing about
them. Sure,
And the fact that all four films were given to different directors.
Well, the pedigree is unbelievable. Yeah, I mean,
radical departures every time too. It's like we're trusting the guy who made Amelie with this, and we're trusting the guy who will. You know, like they're just really bizarre choices, because at the time, Genet had just made Delicatessen.
Yeah, right? Like I think it was the first film that he didn't get co-credited with Mark Caro.
That's right.
Well. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's a DGC rule. You can't until. What's his name? Frank Miller and Rodriguez challenged it for...
Was that the first time?
Well, they challenged it, yeah. But I think Rodriguez had to renounce his membership.
For Sin City?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, to get the co-director credit.
But Fincher, who hadn't made a feature and was now... I keep directing music videos and all of a sudden is entrusted with this. And Cameron, at the time, at least had made Terminator. But it just felt like Fox was going out of their way to cast interesting... or to staff the films with interesting people, interesting writers, interesting directors. And I had heard that Vincent Ward was working on it, but at the time, you know, the conversation wasn't loud enough to really track production changes.
Yeah.
So all I knew was that Vincent Ward, who had made The Navigator, which I absolutely loved, was no longer directing it. This new guy was. I was like, well, all right, but his name's still on the screenplay, so let's see where that goes. And only later did I find out just how radically different it was. And then when you look at the film, it's like you can almost feel it sort of pinwheeling between...
Oh, it's a Frankenstein monster.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, if you take the time, and they're all readily available on the internet, to sort of backtrack through its long, arduous, like, absolutely hellscape production process. I mean, you have to remember, Sigourney Weaver was pretty pissed, because at the end of Aliens, they cut all the daughter stuff out, and she had a big problem with that.
Right.
And I don't even think the success, the commercial and critical success of Aliens, abided that in any way. She had a beef, and it didn't matter how successful the film was. So when they started out on Alien 3, they were going to do it without her. And I think the first person attached, I'll remember my notes, was Rennie Harlan. So they had...
I remember he developed it.
Yeah, they had Harlan on board and they developed it. I think Giller and Hill wrote the first draft of what would become Alien 3. And then, interestingly enough, they pass it off to William Gibson.
I've read his draft.
And he hated his draft. His log line, which is one of my favorites, is Space Commies Hijack Alien Eggs, Big Trouble in Mall World.
Right.
Which is essentially what the script is, right? Like, they hired Gibson to get kind of a Blade Runner-y Neuromancer kind of thing, and they got Aliens Part 2. So they weren't quite happy, and I think at this point the film had been... in development hell for a bunch of years. Sigourney Weaver was sort of warming up to playing Ripley again. But, you know, she came with a lot of a rider, so to speak.
Right.
So as the film moved ahead, They got Eric Red to write it. And then David Toohey, who we all know wrote Pitch Black, eventually wrote and directed Pitch Black.
Which is an amazing alien movie.
And if you read his script, it is so similar to Pitch Black. Especially the stuff in, I think it was, it's Riddick where he goes to the prison planet on... and I think they even call it Furia, which is...
That's right.
They do. And the planet in Alien 3 is Fury 1962 or something like that, right? So it's very interesting because as you go down the line, you see that people that, that did work on Alien 3 that kind of fell by the wayside, they sort of repurposed everything that they did towards their next projects, which is really interesting.
I guess it makes sense, too. Right? If you have a good idea that someone already paid you for, you might as
well... True enough, yeah. I mean, the Toohey script is, you know, there are the protagonist is basically Riddick, just a nicer Riddick. You know, the characters that, that kind of make up the rest of the main cast are very Pitch Black, kind of that murk kind of attitude. Like, it's got... The tone is so similar, it's unbelievable. Is it a successful film? Yes and no. I mean, it dances around its obligations to the characters. I mean, every script... whether it had Sigourney Weaver attached and Michael Biehn and Carrie Henn attached, danced around what to do with those characters, every last one of them. I mean, I think it was the Gibson one where she's in a coma for like the first two acts and then finally Hicks...
I think it is the Gibson.
Yeah, and then finally Hicks like rescues her in a biobed and like throws her in a shuttle and sets her off. And I read recently that was because they were planning to do two films back to back. And she was going to disappear for the first one and then come back for the fourth one.
Okay.
But
I can see why that wouldn't be satisfying.
Yeah. But again, we're talking about a film with one of the most unsatisfying beginnings, like the theatrical version. So yeah.
I like the opening because it is so cruel.
It's so cruel.
It just takes away every victory and it negates the whole thing.
It's so unbelievably cruel. Let's circle back to that. So then we bring on Vincent Ward, who I think used this experience towards one of my favorite underrated films, which is What Dreams May Come.
Okay.
Vincent Ward took the film with Joe Fasano, who wrote it, in a really interesting direction. And the basis of this is that the alien is on a wooden planet. So it's this like prefab Weyland-Yutani kind of wooden space satellite, and all of these aseptic monks are living there, and they're all celibate. You know, like it would be like the old what was it called? Great Skellig, where the Irish monks went to in the Irish Sea, big jutting piece of rock that they just used for...
Like a self-imposed exile thing.
Yeah, and they actually used one of those rocks for the island that Luke hides on in the new Star Wars.
Oh, really?
Yeah, same rock. I'm not sure if it's the same rock, but definitely. And they actually shot all the old temples that are there, like the ancient temples. You see it when Daisy Ray's going up the rock face and stuff like that. So Sigourney Weaver's in it. The idea is that, you know, she's a woman, they're celibate, she's temptation, so they lock her in the basement, and the idea being is that they think the alien is Satan, and so they're fighting like a holy, and they think that the alien has come to their wooden prison, their wooden monastery planet because of temptation, and Ripley's their temptation, and it's a really, really, really high concept script.
Right, yeah, no, she's even, it's the snake.
Yeah, like, yes, it's exactly. The snake and the Garden of Eden. Yeah. So it's really high-minded, it's really elegant. I'm not sure what draft, like how many drafts it made to. So I think that there's still odd areas here and there, but like, it would have cost... $700 billion in 93 to make that movie.
It was one of those things where the second you start to think about it, you can't
practically. You can, it's
maybe
impossible.
Maybe fake some of it on a soundstage, but I think everybody gets so fooled, carried away. Maybe is the wrong term, but everybody gets tricked by how beautiful the original film looks because it's entirely soundstages.
Yeah,
and then just decides we can do that some other way. And you just don't realize what you're dealing with.
It's true.
The minimalism, the control involved in the first film.
Absolutely. Some people call Alien a low-budget film. I mean, it sure as hell doesn't look like
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it's comparatively low-budget.
Yeah, yeah.
But it isn't.
No, look, it's fantastic to look at. Like, yeah. It's just unbelievable. So, yeah, there were a lot of big, big set pieces. There's a battle with the aliens that's kind of like the Jurassic Park fight with the Velociraptors in the tall grass. And then there's a fight in this huge vertical library with all these, like, wooden ladders and the aliens chasing and the monks are, like, jumping from ladder to ladder. So it would have been super, super amazing, but crazy expensive. Yeah. And you're now talking... Aliens comes out 86, Alien 3 is finally released 93, so you're talking about a pretty long period to hang your hat on the audience is coming back, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, testy studio executives, and they must have gone through about, what, 20 regime changes in that amount of time? So, like, you can only imagine that everybody had certain reservations about pushing the button on that one, like, you know, pulling the trigger.
It's amazing, too, because that was a time when you weren't working towards a release date.
Yeah. Right?
Like, they had that trailer. I saw the trailer in front of Point Break in 91.
Oh, wow.
Or rather, I didn't see it. I went out to the snack bar after we got seats. They started the pre-roll, and I missed the trailer that said that this year the aliens will come to Earth.
Right, right, right. The teaser, which had, like, almost no footage in it.
And it wasn't even that year. It was still just, like, nope, completely scrapped, not the movie they made.
Right.
Just part of a marketing plan that didn't pay out.
Yeah, yeah.
And you end up with this... Well, after Ward, Fincher comes on, and they completely reconfigure it. Well, almost completely, about 70%. Yeah. They keep 30% of the ideas.
Yeah.
These prisoners are essentially monks. Some of them are religious fanatics. Some of them are not.
Yeah.
And Ripley arrives alone.
Temptation, woman in an all-male prison.
They come close a couple of times, and you get this weird echo of the original intention, plus the idea that the alien gestates inside something that's not a person for the first time.
Yeah, exactly. Which I forgot to mention.
It was Knox, as you said. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, the this is interesting. One of Sigourney's stipulations for doing Alien 3 was that the final script had to be written by Giller and Hill.
Okay.
Because she thought that other than Cameron, they were the only people that could write Ripley capably.
Interesting.
So they kind of came on board, and it had been a long time since they had submitted a draft. So, like you said, they kind of cobbled together the best of what they had. You know, and I wish I had a figure for this, because what was Superman Lives at the end of the day when they finally pulled the plug on it? What did they spend? Like, upwards of hundreds of millions of dollars on development?
Yeah,
so I wonder how close the number for Alien 3 was when they finally... Because you get a feeling, not just with the script, but with the production as well, that they were out of money. And so all of these, like, ambitions sort of met the fickle line of demarcation of cost, right? Because they had blown so much of their brains out developing this thing. Right. That when they finally got around to making it, they had no patience. And I think that echoes from the script right down to the theatrical release. And certainly...
Well, when you compare it to the longer cut, it's... Yeah.
Yeah.
The cuts, the changes, the slicing of material, it feels increasingly desperate.
Yeah.
And the second half of Alien 3 feels like a sprint when the rest of the movie wasn't. And
sure.
When things show up, the elegance goes away, the grandeur just disappears.
Mm-hmm.
Relationships are, I think for me, it's right at the point where Charles Dance is taken out.
Which is also unspeakably evil.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's such a cheap shot in a film that's already, like, taken the wind out of you, you know?
Yeah. I think the film is the only one of the four Alien movies that the original cycle that really feels to me like you're experiencing clinical depression. Like, you're just being pushed down and down and down into a hole.
Yeah.
And then when you start from the place that it starts from, which is that you are alone, you are gutted, you've got nothing left, and then starts to introduce and you're going to die horribly in a way that you've seen
many people already. Exactly.
And then your last chance at hope is gone. It's this process of everything being stripped away from her until it ends the way it ends, because the whole movie is this process of being made okay with that. But the speed at which that happens Like, if somebody hits the gear shift at some point an hour in, and it just thrusts it into, oh, shit, we forgot we have to make an alien movie. As well as this beautiful allegory.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just a weird mashing of those two, the aesthetic concept and then the execution of it. They're just sort of at war with each other in the second.
Absolutely. And so much of the film is target of opportunity. I mean, it was a co-pro with the UK, obviously. So you've got, you know, a lot of British character actors sort of like populating the grand cast. And I think it was shot in a single location, maybe, like...
I mean, it feels like a soundstage picture.
Yeah. I don't even think that was a soundstage. I think it was like a derelict factory that they rented or something like that.
Yeah, the Foundry stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which also never fully made sense to me. What do these convicts do? What are they producing?
Well, in the... I think it was...
The monks made something, right?
Yeah, everybody made... In all the early drafts, everybody made something. And in the one, the Space Mall one that Gibson did, they have a foundry that sort of shoots steel.
Right.
Through like a cylinder of steel, because the it's in high Earth orbit, right? So it keeps perpetually shooting out this like cylinder of steel to Earth waiting downstairs, right, kind of thing. I don't know. Is it a consequence that they knew in the third act they've got to melt the alien in a foundry and they just sort of put it in this prison planet?
Yeah, or is assume it's all built out of Terminator 2 ending in a foundry, in an ironworks.
Yeah.
Because that's cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, right to that. This is the location that we think we can get. Can you build an ending that fits there?
Sure, sure. But I would say, you know, when you're faced with the dramatic conundrum of, okay, well, we've set up a world where there are no weapons, right? And we set up a prison where they don't have weapons anymore, yeah, right? How are they going to kill this thing?
And it's virtually indestructible anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. To say nothing of the fact that it doesn't work anyway. But I don't know. I mean... The cynic's view would say, all right, well, it gives you the beautiful scene with the cremation of Hicks and Newt and the kind of birth-death dichotomy thing that they do. And it gives them a reason to trap the alien and the whole chase Act 3 thing. But I can see your point. Like, there's a certain slapshod kind of patchwork quilt kind of feel to the film. And I find... that it's successful in spite of that, almost in spite of that, or maybe even as a benefit to that. I mean, just now when you said the film feels like experiencing someone's depression.
Yeah.
Well, we all know David Fincher's relationship with the movie. I mean, he disowns it. I mean, when they did the remasters, he refused to be a part of it, right?
So his absence is really specific.
I know, because out of all of them, I mean, we've heard Ridley talk about Alien, you know, endlessly, right? You know, James Cameron, same thing. You know, I don't expect John to really, like, tell us how his, you know, his inner workings go, and I'm sure the broken English would make it even more difficult.
We talked about it when he came through for Micmacs, and it was briefly. Yeah, he said that, you know, like, he made the movie he wanted to make, the studio was behind him, and people just didn't like it. And like, yeah, that's...
I loved it.
I think it's great too, but it was rejected, you know, like, so resoundingly, even more so than Alien 3, which I guess people were sort of okay with at the time.
Yeah, I think Alien 3 changed the consensus.
It's kind of reclaimed its place 25 years later.
Sure.
And it's insane to me that it's been that long.
I know.
But there's enough going on in Alien 3 that you can't... I mean, I never wrote it off.
Yeah.
I went back and saw it again a week after the press screening because I wanted to see it again.
Yeah.
It was kicking around in my head. But it's the kind of movie that, I mean, it's an unsatisfying experience, if that makes any sense. I just knew that there was a better version of it.
Yeah.
Kicking around.
You see, for me, because all of the other stuff came after that initial visceral shock of my world just being destroyed. Everything after was mitigated by respect for that act, like a begrudging respect for that act, because never before in my wildest imagination had I seen a film that played so, that hewed so evil to audience expectation, what you've invested in the characters. I mean, let's not forget, they killed a cherubic, blonde, 11, 12-year-old girl, right?
And they dissect her. That was the scene that, for me, that was the scene where it's just like, oh, okay, we're going. Like, this movie is not going to stop.
Exactly.
Going all the way.
And so, you know, like, my experience with, you know, art cinema, and you know, what's his name? Goldman said, Hollywood films mean to reinforce and art films mean to destroy. And I think this was my first experience with that kind of art film sensibility where no one is. I mean, and again, it's with rose-colored historical perspective, it's kind of weird that I didn't see it coming, because Alien always treaded in that dark space, in the panic. But, you know, I guess Aliens gave us a light at the end of that tunnel.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Aliens is easily the most conventional movie of all four of them.
Easily.
I mean, unless you see Alien as a slasher movie in space, in which case it does adhere to the roles with the final girl and all.
Right.
But Aliens, Aliens is a conventional film. It's a great one. It's a perfect exercise of gene splicing. Like, you've taken this, they take this property and they turn it into a war movie.
Right.
And it's an amazing, brilliant ride, which I just love so much.
Yeah.
And then Alien 3 comes along and it's the punk version where it's just like, no, you know what? Let's take that all back.
Yeah.
Let's almost, you could almost go from Alien to Alien 3. Without aliens at all, except that she now has these bodies.
Yeah.
But if this had been what had happened to the Narcissus, it would be dramatically consistent, which is, I think, what Fincher is going for. He wants to return to that gothic, hopeless tone of the first film.
Sure, and most explicitly, a lot of people were. I mean, it's right there in the title, like Alien, Aliens, and then with Alien 3, they got rid of the pluralization because they wanted to go back to the one monster in the basement kind of idea, as opposed to, you know, I've got this pulse rifle and I can take you all on. Or in the director's cut, I've got the sentry guns, which were super badass, and you know, I can take out like an entire hive of these guys. So, yeah, in a lot of ways, it is a kind of reversion to the monster in the basement kind of thing, but it's got none of the hope.
Yeah, that's true. Of
Alien. Like, it's got none of the, oh, we're in space now and we're going to find cool stuff in space. And even though it may be bad and horrifying, we're still in space. Like, Alien 3 is like, guess what? Space still has these you know, nooks and crannies where it's absolutely, unrepentantly hopeless. And, like, here we go. Like, but I agree with you. It's a very punk exercise. Like, and, you know, it's really dark and morbid and just such an interesting film that's in it that just it gets into your blood and it won't go away, you know.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing too that explores the, this is going to sound dumb, but it explores the moral relativism that's always present there, you know. In the first movie, it's the corporation willing to sacrifice people, and since we're with the people, we immediately identify with them, 'cause they're dying horribly. And for no reason other than profit. And then Aliens kind of has it with Burke. But as soon as you create a war movie, you have good guys and bad guys.
Right.
There's really no middle ground.
Sure, sure.
And then with this one, we're immediately back to, oh, well, this guy who is that magnificent Charles Dutton monologue that ends with, I am a rapist of women.
It's like, okay,
you're not a good person, but you're doing your best now. And then you add in the reason that Dance's character is there, and then you add in the additional corporate stuff that rears up at the end, which doesn't make a great deal of sense, really.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that this is all happening so quickly, and how did they get there, and what's going on, and we're still limited by space travel and all these
logistics. Sure.
But it happens so fast.
That rescue ship does move at the speed of plot, absolutely.
Right, yeah, and she's not supposed to be able to process it. She's like going by her wits, and even that kind of rehashes a moment from Total Recall with the sweat and the blood.
Right.
But it's just like, by that point, everyone is so committed to their course of action that nothing's going to change it. And I kind of love that about Fincher, that he offers her hope and has her reject it.
Yeah.
That Ripley still has to decide, no, you know what? I'm better off dead.
Everyone
is better off if I'm dead.
Well, there's this like almost exhaustion to the characters.
Yeah.
Like, everybody's exhausted. Like, nobody really has the energy to make a positive or a negative decision. Like, everything falls with such a dull thud. Like, when all the surviving prisoners meet and decide to trap the alien, there's no real denouement to that. It's like, yeah, let's just go. Let's go do it. You know, I think Dutton gets another speech. You know, you want to die on your hands and knees or on your feet. And you know, it has none of that...
Optimism.
Optimism, yeah. Absolutely. Like, it's just... it's so morbid. You know, she asks him to kill her, and he's like, "Oh yeah, I'll do it for you, but you got to help me first," kind of thing. Like the actual meaning of death is kind of muted. Like in many ways, the emotional palette of the film mirrors the visual palette. Like it's all grays and browns and mossy greens and sweat and motor oil. Like it's just, it's such a nihilistic movie. It like, and there's, you know, there's just, it's replete with examples of nihilism. It really is like an unstoppable, like what, hour and 45 minutes, 2 hours of just pure nihilism. Like, you know, like a Bukowski kind of novel or something like that. Like
I mentioned this in the Aliens episode with Michelle Loretta. It's like the one thing that I always took away from this cycle is that everyone who experiences and encounters the alien dies. Everybody. Jones, the cat, is the only survivor of the first three films.
Yep, if true enough.
I mean, I guess some of the convicts will be okay.
Well, only one guy, Morris, the guy who got shot in the leg when he's manning the...
That's right.
Yeah. And he's the one who says, I think Dutton says again, "Oh, I forgot about you. You got a deal that you're going to live forever," kind of thing.
Yeah. So, and he's probably going to get cleansed by Weyland Yutani when they take out the whole station.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is such an insistently dark vision.
And, it really is.
And yeah, as you say, you know, like space travel isn't fun anymore. There's nothing. People are working blue collar jobs. They're just doing it in space and they're dying. And whatever you do, you end up somewhere awful. And Alien Resurrection comes close to redemption of this theme, but only there. We don't get to Earth.
Nope.
It stops before they touch down.
Yeah. And Alien Resurrection is a very different beast because it's so operatic almost. It's like a musical, it's almost like a symphony through film. Like it's got these beats and epochs and movements and stuff like that. Whereas Alien 3, you know, it's got its three acts, but they all circle around the same kind of hole.
Yeah, no, musically speaking, it's a dirge.
Yeah.
Like it's a funeral pyre.
Yeah, it pretty much is, yeah. I mean, it's a step removed from a drone. Like, it's not just a single note, but it hews pretty close to that. Yeah, it's a dirge, absolutely. Yeah.
Even the monster sequences aren't thrilling in that way. They're scary, they're intense, but there's no fun to be had. Like, you don't enjoy a moment of the film.
No.
It's just not there for that.
No, and every time you think you get something to hang your hat on, they take it away.
Yeah.
Every single time.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the an interesting fact, they wanted to cast... what's his name? Richard E. Grant as Charles Dance's character.
For a little Withnell.
Yeah, a little Withnell and I reunion.
That would and, be nice.
But it would have been a totally different... I mean, it's hard enough to accept that Ripley gets horny in the first place, right? Like, it's kind of difficult. And there, you know, if one of my problems, if I have one with Alien 3, is that sort of comes out of nowhere.
Yeah, well, especially if she's still in mourning for the relationship she might have had with Hicks.
Exactly, and she also has, like, you know, if we're to dumb it down to, you know, life as chess game, like, what's the long game for this move, right? Like, is it simply companionship, or you know, or is she looking for a way into the power structure of this like skanky place where they don't even have batteries that work anymore? I mean, it seems to come out of nowhere.
Yeah. Well, there's that sequence that was cut from Alien about, I think it's in the heavy metal comic book.
It's
definitely in the novelization. I remember reading it, where Lambert and Ripley are just talking about casually, like, "Have you ever slept with Ash?" "No, not really." And sex is way more transactional in the future than it is now. It's just, I think it's presumed in the text of Alien that they're just sleeping around constantly.
Everybody on the Nostromo.
There's nothing else to do. You know, you're in space. You might as well occupy yourself.
True enough.
You know, she's had a kid, but we never find out anything about her husband. So
yeah, we never ever do.
Buried.
Yeah, it's all buried. Absolutely. Yeah.
And who knows in the 22nd century what the priorities are, or what the structure is.
Sure.
But yeah, in this one, there's still rape, obviously.
Obviously.
But... and in so many different forms, because that's ultimately what the xenomorph represents.
Yeah, yeah.
But the idea of a relationship, I don't know, she just seems to like him.
Yeah.
So that's it, it just happens. But does it mean anything else? And obviously the fact that he's killed immediately.
In the worst possible way.
Post-monologue. Like... that suggests to me that the movies don't care about sex either.
Yeah.
It's really only ever just a means to an end.
Sure, sure.
And
fair point.
Resurrection doesn't really have any sexual relationships either, right?
Well, Resurrection's got the underlying theme of, like, sexuality and, you know, like, Sigourney's vamping it up with her alien DNA, right? And she definitely takes a sort of burlesque kind of sex kitten guise in that film. But yeah, no, any thread you pull out of Alien 3 in a quest for some kind of happiness or positivity,
yes, leads only to despair.
And I can't think of another film. You see, what gives the despair so much power is this a franchise film, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just insane that someone said they were okay with this. because it flies in the face of the whole point of a franchise film. You don't kill your protagonist because right. that ends the franchise right then and there. Item B, you kind of want to give people a reason to come back. And if you're just like throwing hot oil over the ramparts at them, your audience is done. So the singular fact that the film got made just boggles my mind. And then the fact that, I mean, I'm not surprised that it had the impact critically that it did, because it is just so dark and disturbing. But I am happy that history has kind of vindicated it a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think if it had actually been the end of the series, it would be still hated. I think.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the redemption comes because they made 5 more Alien movies.
True.
And none of them is as good as this one. Like, they just don't measure up. I like Resurrection, but it's just weird and flawed.
Yeah, yeah. And I like Prometheus and Covenant because they're ambitious, but, you know, they've really played fast and loose with my story.
They're so dumb. I want to like them so much, and they just won't let me.
Yeah.
Just this last one, I'm stunned by Alien Covenant because it starts so well, because it almost feels like it's going to get it right. And then they just turn it back into the same thing that they always do, which is Ridley Scott insisting that you need these things explained to you.
You don't.
And yeah, no.
You don't. What made Alien so scary is that it wasn't explained.
Yeah.
Right? And that the xenomorph was just part of space. Space is vast. It's endless. There's some nasty stuff out there. Watch out.
Yeah. And even Aliens, you know, like that gorgeous tagline that they had, there's some places in the universe you just don't go alone.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. That's the spirit of the first film. And now we have guns and they still don't really help.
Yeah.
And then Prometheus comes along and I think I'm going to explain the space jockey. Oh, but it turns out I'm not actually doing that. Then the next, like with Covenant, I don't need to know that the facehuggers were perfected by a person because... What does that mean?
Makes the universe so much smaller.
Yeah, smaller and pettier.
You're right, and pettier.
Especially if this technology is only, you know, 100 years old or 80 years old or however old it's supposed to be now. It doesn't make any sense. And the queen, I mean, yes, okay, there wasn't a queen, and then Cameron brilliantly figured out a way to do that.
Sure, sure.
And it's still dumb. Like, it's it's still dumb in Covenant because none of this stuff has any purpose. And if the idea is that Michael Fassbender's are running around endlessly bothering people in space, you can make a franchise where it's that. You don't have to make it an Alien franchise.
Sure, exactly.
Like, imagine if Prometheus was a standalone. It could have been something else, but because it's loaded with all of this imagery and all these reference points, it can't help but disappoint.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But thanks to those examples, we have Alien 3 as an example of purity.
Like, which is weird in historical context, that it's an example that... That the tide has shifted so much that now we look at Alien 3 as like a pure expression of the narrative.
Yeah.
When, you know, you go back in time and people were screaming bloody murder.
Oh, no, people like, hated it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
People hated it.
So it's interesting because, you know, Alien 3 avoids the temptation to explain anything.
I mean, even Ripley doesn't share information when she could.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing how unhelpful she is.
She is pretty unhelpful,
in that situation. So, this monster parasite inside me. And I know what's going on, but I'm mad.
Yeah, so what happened last time? Everybody died. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And Bishop, you know, like, we didn't even get to talk about Lance Henriksen and how good he is under a ton of makeup. In that first Bishop sequence.
Oh, it's great. It's great.
And then he asks to be put down, which is just like, again, her one friend left, taking that away from him.
Sure.
everything is going, everything is leaving. And then when he's reintroduced at the end, I got to talk to him that year, I think, for Jennifer 8.
Cool.
I was on the junket for that, and we chatted, and we had enough time, because this was back in the days when, oh, and Lance Henriksen is here. Would you also like to talk to him?
Right, right, right.
Yes, how much time? We talked about that, and we talked about Alien 3 and Pit and the Pendulum more than anything
else. Nice,
because they're two really interesting performances from him. And he said with Bishop, he would have happily come back and played the whole thing as a half alien, a half android. He would have, like, he said, like, you know what, build me a wheelchair, I would do that.
Right.
And they weren't interested in it. That's not where the show was going. He ended up doing what he does. And what he does is, like, it's really eloquent and sweet. It's
fantastic.
And it's because, I mean, it's funny. He said something when we talked that I've never forgotten, because I had the same response. It's like, he never thought he was playing Bishop, even in Aliens. He never played Bishop as villainous. And he said it was amazing how many people were waiting for a turn because of Ash.
Yeah.
And his whole point was, no, I say right up front, we have inhibitors. I can't do that.
Yeah,
I can't
be
bad. And I was like, yeah, I believed you. He's like, well, thank you. I tried to make it as honest as possible. And it's like, people didn't want to trust him. And then so in Alien 3, he's completely unburdened by that.
Right.
But then when he reappears, you instantly don't trust him.
Instantly.
Your brain starts arguing with itself in that moment.
Well, I mean, physically, he's got the face for that duplicity, right?
Yeah.
It's very much in his wheelhouse, and it was a brilliant bit of casting, because I think even more so than Ian Holm, he just looks like he's pulling one over on you all the time. So
even though his face is utterly guileless, like his voice is always calm, he never shouts, but you can't fully trust him.
You can't fully trust him. And then that shot in Alien, like through the tunnel, where you're right down the barrel of him, and like just the way
he's crawling.
Yeah, in Alien, how can you not think he's up to no good, right? Yeah. Now, that was an interesting build, the Henriksen head, right? Because he's obviously poking out of a table, and they've got like the thing like a bib on him, sort of thing.
Yeah.
But you don't see the seams.
No.
Like, I think that's one of the last practical, almost animatronic Stan Winston-y kind of stuff.
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, they would have started. Yeah. I mean, even the Terminator movies started doing more CG stuff.
Yeah.
After, Terminator 2 did it perfectly. But then subsequently, like, there's the fake Schwarzenegger heads in 3.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Fighting. The
Uncanny Valley nonsense.
Yeah. Oh, and Salvation. But, it is. And then that does give us the CG alien in Alien 3, which is... It didn't look great at the time. It looks worse now.
Yeah, it looks Babylon 5 now.
Yeah.
But let's be honest, when they... Alien 3 is the first time they do the POV from the alien's perspective.
Right.
And I thought they did a way better job on that visual effect in Alien 3 than they do in Covenant.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because Covenant's that, like, bees, like, hexagonal kind of nonsense.
Which doesn't make it doesn't even make any sense.
And I mean, the alien CG in Covenant is so weightless and lifeless. Like, there's no... You don't feel... The creature, like, you don't, like, they're just, you
know? Same thing happens in Resurrection, too, in the swimming sequence. It's a great image.
It's a great image,
They move weird.
They do move weird.
You can feel that they're, and I guess if you start with a man in a suit, you should stick to it. Like, that's just, the first two films use suits.
They're
amazing suits. Cameron made he had 6 suits. He made an incredible use of those.
Sure.
And then with 3, it's down to 1 monster, and the monster isn't quite there. Like, your brain doesn't register it the same way you do practical effects, just because at that point the effects...
They were found lacking. Yeah.
Not quite there.
Yeah. But I dig the dog alien. I love the dog / ox alien. Yeah, like, the idea
of it is great.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And what it adds to the mythology, because, I mean, just to circle back to the earlier drafts, they were still playing with the world building of how the alien's life cycle goes, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know... anybody that's a fanboy is well aware that in the Scott version, they were supposed to turn into the ovoid sacs themselves, which is way less scary than the Cameron, you know, like waking up just before the chestburster says hello.
Yeah.
And then the instantaneous chestburster for, what's his name? Jesus. Yeah. No. Yeah. What's his face in, Covenant, I want to say...
Jim.
Yeah,
Billy... high-speed Billy...
There you go, Billy Crudup.
You were going to say Caviezel.
Yeah, I always get them mixed up.
Similarity. Yeah, because Gibson introduced that in his script, right? Because there was a viral alien.
Yeah. Which they copied in Covenant with the spores. Yeah,
makes no sense.
No, I mean, it is interesting, and I guess you can't be surprised that there's this wealth of material that 20th Century Fox possesses, so that every time they go back to the trough, they're like, how can we... get some value back from all of this stuff. So
I assume there's just some big dusty card catalog. They haven't even digitized it yet, but they've just got all the bullet points of what happens in every version of every draft of Alien 3 that never got used.
That presupposes that there's any continuity in Hollywood, right? And you got to imagine that every time the regime changes, it's like a ghost town in there for a day and then...
Burn it all.
But I mean... Again, the proof is in the pudding. There are so much from there may not be any new ideas in the world, but it's hard to escape the commonality that runs through of like something borrowed, something repurposed. For me, it's hard to say it's the purest expression of the alien concept, because there really isn't one. Like you were saying, everybody brings their that's why I appreciate the series so much, is that everybody brought their own skill set to the table, and for the most part, and I think Fincher included, despite his sort of distance from the film, they got to bring their own perspective to it. It's a Fincher film.
And then when Seven came out, 3 years later, it just felt that made sense of Alien.
Absolutely. I think I enjoyed Seven more as a consequence of how much I dug Alien 3, because I kind of knew what I was getting.
Yeah,
you know?
I can totally see that. If you enjoyed Alien 3, 7 instantly makes sense to you. In the first 10 minutes. You know what you're getting.
Well, it mines the same kind of territory.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it apes Blade Runner a bit more than Alien 3 does. But,
sure. Well, I mean, just the municipal setting, like the urban stuff.
And the constant rain and the smoke everywhere and the, like... But, Alien 3's got a lot of smoke.
Oh, yeah.
And it's got a lot of dripping vents, so I suppose we could call that rain.
Yeah. I mean, it has everything except the spinning circular fan. It must have a spinning circular fan in 2 or 3 places.
I think it's got some spinning circular fans.
That's
world. And the hanging chains that's everywhere, right?
Chains from Nostromo.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. It's, Well, it just, it feels like, I always wonder how many takes he got, how much of his current style is derived from having what he thought was a bad experience on Alien 3, where the vision is like 80% his. It's clearly
a Fincher movie, right? Clearly.
But he's not happy with it. So where do you...
Well, does that just come from inexperience, right? It's a big studio film. They sank a lot of money into developing. They wanted to get it done cheaply, quickly.
Yeah.
And they hired an untrained first-time feature director.
Yeah,
so
this is probably the only movie he really imagines as work for hire, right? Like, everything else was him calling the shots.
Which is strange, because he comes from commercial background, so how can he not understand a work for hire, right? Because the commercial game is, like, insane tight deadlines. And, art, it plays second fiddle to delivering and making everybody happy. Yeah. So,
but on music videos, you get a final cut. And maybe that was it.
Yeah.
Because that's a perfect, 3-minute experience that he's creating.
And he was working with Madonna, and he was working with the Rolling Stones. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's not like he hadn't dealt with big egos.
Yeah.
But you're right. You know, there's probably some truth in that. He had final cut on those videos.
Yeah, and he's not answering. He's really, even with these giant artists, he's still in charge. And so now you put him in a studio situation where he's the new boy, even though he's been working for 10 years, and they're just not listening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe he was absolutely the wrong person for the job, even though I love the movie and I'm so glad he did it. But you have to think that, or maybe he was the right person for the job and that this was just, it had to happen. It made him a better filmmaker, right?
Yeah.
Because certainly when it came around time to do Seven, I mean, that's a pretty pure expression in an auteurist sense, right? So,
of the same core ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, what's in the ball? I mean, Seven is not, there's no happy endings in Seven either. So, which then surprises me why he would disown it so much and why he wouldn't make the same connection. Like, you know, this was a struggle, but can you safely say that any first kick at the can, like your first feature is not going to be a struggle, right?
Someday I hope to just be able to get 2 minutes with him just to ask him if maybe he dug in at the time and now he's reconsidering.
You know, you're probably right, because like he had the experience with the Stones and Madonna and with Final Cut, so he dealt with egos that were way bigger than any studio executive.
Right.
Right? So you have to imagine that it was a tight wire act for him, because he had the self-belief required, as a consequence, but he, like you said, he wasn't getting listened to. He wasn't feeling like, you know, he was given his artistic berth or like the polite distance.
Yeah. He certainly wasn't being treated as the creative partner he was. Right. By the end of it, when, you know, if you look at the assembly cut, there are ideas in there that simply got snuffed out. He just right. wasn't allowed to express them.
And as much as I love the assembly cut and as much as I love the trapping the alien in the waste receptacle, mm-hmm. it is kind of anti-three-act structure. Like, it is kind of a step backwards to step forwards again. It's a bit of a reset button in the middle of, like, what, I guess the second half of Act 2.
The descent of Act 2.
Yeah, yeah, so...
Maybe that's it, too, because it plays like False Hope, and we know it's not going to work. We just, like, as
an audience, and I think that may be why it was cut, because at that point, no living person is going to expect any hope in this film, right? Yeah.
And the audience for the Alien movies is already
exactly.
ahead of them.
So in some cases, I think that it helped with the pacing. But again, you mentioned it right at the outset. There's a huge pacing problem in the film. Like, the first half is elegant and sort of measured. And then the second half is just Mad Max Fury Road, right? Yeah. It's just like this unstoppable freight train to its massively unsatisfying conclusion. This is why I love the film so much, is I could talk about it forever. Like, there's so much you can take away with respect to, you know, real knowledge, like as a working filmmaker, like how do you navigate the studio system? And I don't think it is so far removed for time-wise that you can take nothing away from Fincher's experiences. So there's all of that. There's like, you know, how there's the sort of cautionary tale, like, you know, they want you because you're an artist, but then they get you and they want you to deliver it really quickly and not say anything when they have, when it's a bullshit notes party or whatever the case may be. And then there's the takeaway of what a brave film, and whether it's brave as a consequence of the exhaustion of everybody involved or whether it's brave, because they just balls to the wall went for this like dystopian fever dream of badness, you have to salute that. I mean, films this hardcore dark don't come along that often, and so you have to celebrate that for better or worse. It's a Frankenstein monster. We'll never know exactly how all the pieces fit together, and I think that's part of the allure of it, right? Because you bring your own kind of viewing apparatus to the party, sort of thing, your own subjective viewpoint.
You create the connective tissue.
Exactly. Yeah. But the film rewards your knowledge of the series. It rewards your knowledge of the minutiae of the, like, the film is, it's endless. It's hard to say about a film that's so not rewarding in the classical sense, but I find it endlessly rewarding when you start to scratch at it, because I do think it's aged pretty, I think it's aged evenly. Like, I rewatched it again and I was like, God, there are some parts here that are just excruciating to watch. And the CG is, you can see the seams. But, you know, if you compare it to, if you compare the CG in Alien 3, this is another thing that just occurred to me. So because the CG was so much in its infancy back then, usually you had nighttime scenes, sort of hid the seams. But you're seeing the CG alien and not, I mean, there's nothing that's full lit in this movie whatsoever.
There's a lot of reds, there's a lot
of
brightness.
But you're definitely given the opportunity to go, oh, I can see the seams, which in itself is brave for a 1993 film that's using computer-generated effects, right? Mm. So, you know, the cynic devil's at the devil on your shoulder is going to say, well, it was a rush job, it was a hack job, blah 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 blah, that's why it looks stupid. You know, they didn't even have the opportunity to light it in darkness because they just wanted to get the thing out of there. And then you know, the angel on your shoulder is all the stuff that I've been saying for the last
hour. Look what they tried to do, and it is mostly successful.
Yeah,
especially in the rearview mirror.
Exactly. I'll take it, you know. That I think That would be one of the reasons why I would want to talk to Fincher so badly, because I'm so curious as to why he hates it so much. Because at the end of the day, if my name was on that movie, I'd be pretty proud of it.
Yeah. And you he's doing a World War Z sequel now, which, I mean, sure.
Sure.
Why not? He's helping his buddy.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, if he's making that, he's got to be proud of this.
Yeah.
on some level. Maybe this is...
Well, he's establishment now, right? So it's, you know, and that's awesome that David Fincher is establishment, but like... As an, it would be interesting to see what he thinks about the film now, even now, as opposed to when they did the assembly cut, right?
Yeah. And that's what the Alien Anthology, the Quintilogy, the Quadrilogy was like 98, 99. It was so, early days for DVD.
Yeah, so he was what, coming?
He was barely 15 years out when they did the last remaster.
But where was that in his career trajectory? Like, was that The Game or?
After The Game, the box set was put together.
So what was
The first... Oh, I knew this. The first box set was rushed out pretty fast because they weren't even widescreen.
Yeah.
Like 16:9.
Yeah.
And then the quadrilogy was established, was released like 2001, 2002. So maybe 20 years after Alien.
So what was 7, made, The Game, and then...
Oh, what was
that? Panic Room? No,
yeah, I think... right around that time. It must have been. That was 2002.
Was Panic Room really his fourth film?
I think so.
Interesting.
No, Fight Club. Fight Club.
Oh, of course. Oh my God, right. Of course.
Fight Club is what got back into Fox to talk about.
Of course. Yeah. Panic Room.
That's bizarre. Fight Club is so iconic that it's transcended him. And that I apologize to the people who've been yelling Fight Club for the last minute. While
we're idiots. Sorry. Fight Club.
Yeah.
What was that movie that Orson Welles made? I can't remember. Yeah. There was like a sled in it.
Citizen Ralph.
Yeah. I can't believe we forgot Fight Club. We went so far up Alien 3's bum that we forgot Fight Club, but that's hilarious.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean...
by that point, though, he'd cemented himself.
Yeah.
Because even though Fight Club underperformed, it was still clearly... Like, it was accepted as a visionary work.
Yeah.
It wasn't...
I mean, Fincher's doing all right. Like, he's got, like, Fight Club and Seven are, like, right up in the pantheon of, like, massively influential films that everybody apes from. And, yeah,
and people still talk about The Game 20 years later.
The Game is a kind of dark horse for me. I really, really dig it. But I don't know if it's Sean Penn. He kind of pisses me off. And I do think he's a pretty terrific actor, but he just... Everybody's so spineless in that movie. I realize that it's like, again, you can Fincher is obsessed with certain concepts, like every filmmaker, but like this whole like spineless bourgeoisie that permeates The Game, like everybody's just such a douchebag, right? And like,
I think that's why Fight Club makes the perfect answer to it.
Yeah,
because it's just it tilts all the way the other way, in a ridiculous way,
and it hangs its hat on a beautiful, beautiful narrative. Like the twist is gorgeous. Even if you can see it coming from a mile away, it's an amazing twist. So narratively, it hangs its hat. Like, its game is tight narratively. So he gets to explore all these wonderful visual things. And I mean, going back to Panic Room, like, what did he build, like a dolly track through a house to shoot that film? Like, I can't, you know.
Well, there's that CGI thing through the coffee maker.
Right.
That's such a fun movie.
It's a fun little movie.
Can you believe, I know I've had this conversation on the podcast before, but I'm still stunned that there's no Blu-ray of it. There is no.
I am stunned.
Anywhere in the world, not even Japan or Germany, where they love his stuff so much. No high definition. I'm just assuming it's going to go straight to 4K for Criterion or something. That'll be there for
Yeah, I wouldn't be so sure, because if there's no release anywhere, that must mean that the rights are in like some serious...
No, Sony owns it. They've just never done it.
Why not?
I don't know.
Damn. Because my first inclination would be like, it's a rights quagmire.
No,
like,
I thought so too, but I looked into it, and it's to Sony Pictures through and through.
Wow.
Yeah. It's just...
They got a hate on for Fincher over there.
It makes no sense at all. They must have lost them so much money on something else, on some post-development project that never happened.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Well, so this does sort of organically bring us to the final question. You sort of teased it, but, you know, like, is there anything of Alien 3 that you've used or borrowed or absorbed in your own creative DNA?
This film's in my creative DNA. Like, I don't know where it ends and I begin. Like, I saw it at an age... I mean, the reason why I am a filmmaker is my parents let me see Jaws and Poltergeist too early, right? Nice. So I'm afraid of bathtubs. I'm like the ocean, forget about it. Clown dolls, forget about it. Like, I slept with my duvet on in an angle tucked under my head for like the better part of my adolescence. Those films scared the piss out of me. So everything that I said about Alien 3, like, just the punk ethos of it, right? Like, it really is, you know, if Suicide, the band, you know, Martin Rev and Alan Vega were a movie, they'd be Alien 3. Like, just this, like, this visual and narrative terrorism. Like, hey, you like the chiseled jawed blonde soldier. Well, guess what? He was impaled. You like the 11-year-old girl? Well, she drowned in her cryo tube. Like, the sort of that really nasty punk spirit that informs Alien 3 is probably the biggest takeaway. But also that, that's the biggest takeaway. And then I'm trying to find like some kind of redemption in Alien 3, right. but I think that's the noose that it gave me, like to kind of take that furious punk energy, but marry it to something that's a bit less overtly nihilistic. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, it's too beautiful to be that ugly. Except that
exactly. Right? There's such a beauty in that ugliness, right? Like that. I think you hit the nail on the head. Like, if you're gonna go there with a smile, yeah. Right? Just how it destroyed my paradigm. Like, Alien 3 was my way into the minutiae of the Hollywood system because I was so destroyed by it. That I was like, how did this happen? Like, right. Who killed my Newt? Who killed my Hicks? Like, how the hell did this happen? So then, that was the impetus for me to explore the unglamorous side of movie making and how films come together and how, you know, sometimes the best of intentions lead to development hell, or like in the case of Fincher, like a young hot filmmaker completely disowns his work, kind of thing. Mm. It was my window into a whole new sensibility, absolutely, cool. Artistically and the business side of things.
Do you? I mean, you know about the Neil Blomkamp thing, right?
Yeah,
his promises to make another Alien movie that somehow resets the chronology, erases Alien 3, and starts anew. That just makes me mad on a whole bunch of levels, and I'm just wondering how you feel about it. Like, what was your first response when you heard of the plan?
Fear. Because, I can't... Retconning is one of my worst enemies, right? Like, I think, especially in the genre scope, you owe something to your continuity. If you're building a world, you have an obligation to the world you've built. And, you know, they licensed it to Dark Horse, and then Dark Horse went down a path and stuff.
Yeah, there are a million different comic
book versions. It's difficult to answer the Blomkamp question two films into Ridley Scott's reimagining of it, because would it have been worse? Probably not.
That's an interesting question. I hadn't even thought about it that way. It's like, would you prefer going forward in the wrong way than going backward in an unsatisfying way?
Yeah.
But I just, like, for me, it strikes me as this weird insistence that the series went wrong and he can fix it. And I, having seen his other films, I have no faith in that.
Well, I wanted to avoid that because...
No, I can say it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's totally fine.
So
nothing in his movies gives me the sense that he can...
But he's a huge fanboy for it, so you got to give him that, right? Right. So, like...
But it'll just end up being aliens again.
Well, that's the thing. I as much as Covenant and Prometheus kind of went off in a direction that I don't think anybody wanted them to go in, they still weren't, you know, alien. Like, yeah. How many copycat films have been made of Alien, Aliens? Not Alien 3, obviously, but,
yeah.
You know, like the blender of the space monster kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think there is no audience would accept that at this point. Like, if you're just going to do a paint by numbers kind of Aliens movie sort of thing, especially if he had gone back and retconned Alien 3 and kind of created this like alternate cosmology where it's just more of the same. Right. So if he had gone and made Aliens 2, I think it would have been an abomination.
And again, it just tells us that Fox did the right thing by abandoning that and going with Alien 3 and making something else in 92 when they could have gone for more of the same.
Yes, just absolutely.
They've never been interested in that. It's like it's so weird that the two major franchises that Cameron's been involved with, Terminator and Alien, mm-hmm. one is famous for its shape-shifting.
Yeah.
And the other is constantly trying to recapture
it's
thing that
he infamous gave it. For its cyclical nonsense.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah. He's coming back to it again, and I just, you know, do something you want to do.
Don't, yeah.
don't make another
Time. Well, doing what he wants to means we're sitting through avatars. 18 avatars.
Yeah, you know? But those will be fine. There's nobody who hates Avatar. They just don't like it.
Yeah, no, I don't. I absolutely don't hate it. I've seen it far too many times to hate it.
Indifference to its existence, right? So there'll be another one and it'll be a fun ride.
Yeah, like it wasn't, walking out of the theater of Avatar was not walking out of Phantom Menace, right?
Right. Like, like a James Cameron Terminator movie just makes me think, okay, we'll get one new idea that's really interesting, but it's still going to be a Terminator movie because that's what it has to be.
Yeah.
They only have one mode.
Well, okay, here's the problem. Here's one of the... Ripley is human, so she can age.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
The Terminator can't age, so you keep putting Schwarzenegger in here, and you've got to explain his aging away.
Right.
And then you end up with Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, right? Where it's like, no one wants that, right? So, yeah, could the Terminator films work without a reliance on Arnie?
Yeah.
Possibly.
I think with Cameron driving, yes. I mean, I'm sure it's possible.
Sure.
Because he's capable of imagining a world where that's possible. But as long as the franchise, just like Alien, really, as long as the franchise stays so invested in the idea of this monster,
yeah,
this one thing, this key image.
Sure.
And that's what Alien 3 was supposed to do and then didn't because Resurrection brought back Ripley.
Right.
The idea is that you can abandon or end or climax and walk away.
Yeah.
And leave it in ruins and see what else happens.
That's what you said. Like, if they had, if Alien 3 had been the end of the Sigourney Weaver era.
Yeah, people'd still be mad at it.
Super. Super duper mad at it. I mean, it would be, I don't know if they would have been able to resurrect the series with another character.
They
might
have switched into the Alien versus Predator stuff earlier.
Yeah.
Because that was already a thing.
Well, the first one wasn't terrible. I mean, I love Paul W.S. Anderson. Event Horizon is one of my favorite films.
Yeah.
You know, Mortal Kombat is neither here nor there.
I kind of like Mortal Kombat. I remember seeing it in the theater and thinking, you know what, if you have to make a movie like this, this is a fine way
to do it. I mean, it's better than anything Uwe's thrown out in the video game adaptations. Yeah. But like Event Horizon, I mean, if someone said to me, pick a movie that you want to remake, now that BSG's gone, I would take Event Horizon in a heartbeat.
That's interesting. I wonder what you could do now.
Well, I wouldn't hold back. Like, I would make the Event Horizon Alien 3...
Like the Hellraiser.
Yeah, but the hopeless one. Like, absolutely hopeless. Like, because I think Event Horizon very much occupied a bit of that world, but there was still some kind of...
Well, it was that was a major studio movie that references a creepy horror film, but doesn't really embrace it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so leaning into it, I mean, even Hellraiser had the one in space, but we don't talk about it.
No, we don't talk about it. Just like the Jason in space.
Leprechaun,
they always seem to go to space.
Never go to space. Horror movies shouldn't go to space.
And they take a bunch of virginal teens with them.
You have to.
Well, of course, when you're going to space, you need to bring a bunch of original teens with you.
God, the only thing worth mentioning about Hellraiser in space is that Adam Scott is in it.
Oh yeah,
playing a Frenchman.
That's true.
Again, we don't speak of it.
How was his hair game? Was it
pretty good?
Yeah,
pretty good hair.
Yeah,
French hair.
His hair game's amazing. Adam Scott's got amazing hair. What was it? The one that the movie's about to come out with him and Craig Robinson.
Oh, Ghosted the Show.
Yeah. There was a blurb in Entertainment Weekly where Robinson was like, Adam Scott's hair was ruining my acting game because I kept looking at it and he's like, I'm better than you. Like,
I have met Adam Scott and his hair is amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty good hair. Everybody wants that hair. It's good. It's good do.
All right, so Alien 5B with Adam Scott's hair versus... Well, we can get there.
Alien versus RoboCop versus the Terminator. We'll just take all the 20th Century Fox
versus
property.
Versus Preda hair.
Yeah, versus Preda. Adam Scott's Preda hair. I like that.
I'll watch it.
Yeah.
My thanks to Jeff Nesker, whose debut feature, Elsewhere New York, is now available for rental and purchase on iTunes in Canada and on iTunes and Amazon Video in the U.S. You should check it out. You can find Jeff on Twitter at Jeffrey P. Nesker, all one word, and you can find Alien 3 on Blu-ray and DVD from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment. The Blu-ray is a terrific special edition, offering the theatrical cut and the extended version and a whack of great contextual supplements, but you can also find both versions of the film on iTunes and Google Play. That's kind of cool. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at nowtoronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast. And on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or wherever, that would be greatly appreciated. As I've said before, every little bit really does help. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening.